You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
It would seem it's not just Guy Ritchie who gets inspiration from medieval Arthurian lines, but also Michael Bay as well, as we launch episode 5 of Past Prologue with a terrific triumvirate, including yourself, and of wonderful contributors.
Yes, here we are again. I think we've all just about recovered from the election, which was, of course, what we were talking about last time.
We've had an election, have we? I'm sure we'll have another one before too long, but we won't go there at this particular
moment. Very likely, very likely.
Exactly.
So, sorry.
I've just got to say, Guy Ritchie and obviously his Arthurian scenarios, but also Transformers, Michael Bay in full force there with Sir Anthony Hopkins as well, doing magical Merlin things, Transformers The Last Knight. So talk about your Past Prologue. Clearly Hollywood is learning from this programme, Finn.
Yes, you're making me think I ought to go and see the film now. I've so far, the Transformers have...
It's a guilty pleasure. I didn't expect to enjoy it, but I went there, and it's got lots of laugh-out-loud moments. It's extraordinary, particularly Sir Anthony Hopkins' review to the staff outside number 10 Downing Street. I shall say no more. He says a word which we can't say on Past Prologue, and quite rightly so. Over to you, Finn.
The mind boggles. So yes, we are talking about medievalisms this month, and I have with me two excellent colleagues, Dr. Andrew Elliott. Hello. From Lincoln School of Film and Media, and Dr. Renee Ward from the School of English and Journalism. And part of the jumping off point for this was also the fact that Andrew has got a new book out on medievalism, politics and mass media appropriating the Middle Ages in the 21st century. And I think some of the themes and arguments in that book are likely to come back into the conversation later.
Absolutely.
But I thought we perhaps ought to start with a fairly sort of general question, which is, what exactly is this thing called medievalism?
Okay, well, it's always the most difficult thing to define the discipline in which you work in the simplest forms. But essentially, medievalism refers to the study or the pursuit or the creation of anything medieval or from the Middle Ages in any period after the Middle Ages. At its most simplest definition, that's exactly what it is and what we do.
I would add, though, that it also took place in the Middle Ages.
This is also an important point. I like that we're disagreeing already within the definition.
Well, I mean, the Middle Ages covers almost a millennia, so you have kind of somebody like Chaucer reworking texts that are hundreds of years old or not so far apart from his own, but the sense of rewriting or adapting or re-envisioning material taking place in the Middle Ages
And that's really at the heart of medievalism as well, and the recognition that the Middle Ages aren't something closed and finished and finite that we can pack away and put into a box. It's something that's living, breathing, and that continues, or even was, you know, part of the process of recognizing the world in which they lived in the Middle Ages themselves. You know, if you look at people like Petrarch, they were already complaining about the medieval minds of their predecessors, you know, in a sense, essentially or ostensibly a Renascimento that was 100 years ahead of the rest of Europe. So it's never been compartmentalized as much as we might like it to be for convenience sake. So it's the recognition that these are living, breathing and evolving ideas. And so medievalism in terms of its scholarly pursuit, which we'll discuss in a moment, but in its scholarly pursuit we'll recognize the ways in which they are slippery, difficult to grasp, and also can be stretched to an alarming degree.
So can anyone even agree on dates for the Middle Ages, or is this an additionally contentious subject covering...
Well, I mean, Richard Utz and Elizabeth Emery in the Key Terms, or Critical Guide to Medievalism, kind of frame it around the fall of Rome to the fall of Constantinople. So that's the period that they see as a fluid boundary, recognizing that it's not necessarily going to be a fixed date on either end. But
But then again, Norman Cantor, he comes in with an argument that says, you know, quite often people will date it with things like, you know, Bosworth Field at one end and, you know, with the fall of Rome at the other end. He says you can't have it ending or beginning with one kind of military maneuver and ending with a different kind of military maneuver, or the dissolution of the monasteries. You can't have, you know. So this argument goes on and on and on. And I actually quite like, there's an article by Fred Robinson where he says that we agree that the medieval period ends where the classicists stop working and begins where the early modernists start working, and if they can't decide where their respective periods begin and end, then that's their problem, not ours.
Cool. All of which would explain this phenomenon of you were talking about, with people in the period itself being in disagreement about terms and what it meant to be medieval and making these problematic, you know, making these internal comparisons and so forth. So the other question that follows on from that is, if it's always been going on, and indeed was going on in the Middle Ages itself, and this sort of appropriation and looking back and so forth, have we seen a kind of increase in recent times? Has it come back into vogue again after a gap? Or would you say that there's just been a sort of ongoing, fairly constant engagement, appropriation, and so forth?
I would say ongoing, but perhaps with sometimes being more in vogue than at other times. Certainly, we have peaks that seem to get a lot of critical attention, the Victorian period being the one kind of prior to the 20th century that is extensively studied, but Shakespeare is drawing heavily on the Middle Ages when he writes his history plays. So it's not something that disappears. It is constantly happening. The Victorians found specific uses for it, and I think it had a particular cultural currency as they grew, as the British Empire grew, and as they tried to reshape their narrative about their own history and continuity of history, and even in places where they tried to create a pure racial past, often in response to things that were happening in France or elsewhere in the world, and to justify empire and expansionism. So certainly it gets put to uses in different periods in different ways, but it has always been there. I would say that what shifts, especially in the 20th century, so at the end of the 19th into the 20th century, is how it's viewed in academic terms. Because the study of the Middle Ages was often, especially in the early 19th century, was often the area of the amateur. So this would be the antiquarianism that spent a lot of time collecting or studying things in their spare time. And over that century, especially as folklore and philology become more scientific in their methods, there's a real shift into the academic realm, and it becomes more institutionalized. And even now, I would say, as scholars that work in it, even though medieval studies has become institutionalized, the idea of medievalism itself is fractured. So there's this sense that what is considered to be acceptable or popular or academic versus popular understandings or studies of the Middle Ages tend to be classified differently. So, and this is Richard Utz talks about this, sure, again, this idea of what is considered canonical or institutional is the medieval studies and the things that are done by the amateurs, and those outside of the academic realm tends to be medievalism or plural medievalisms or even neo-medievalism, sure, if you get into technological terms. So there's this real sense that it's existed both within and outside of mainstream culture and academic culture, and that it does exist on the margins as well. And I think that the work that's happened in the 20th century, especially by Leslie J. Workman and Kathleen Verdun, to make the idea of studying the Middle Ages in popular culture or popular reception a more academic field was crucial for the kind of work that we do. We wouldn't be sitting here getting paid to do it otherwise.
And you can still see relics and remnants of that kind of division and that divisiveness in the geographic spread of medievalism. It's a very much an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon, and still catching up in continental Europe. That's not to say that they're backward in any way. It's just there's more of a kind of a momentum towards medieval studies over medievalism. So I think you can see that spread as exactly that same sort of process there.
light the candle, John. The daylight is almost gone. The birds have sung their last. The bells call out to mass. Sit here by my side, for the night is very long. There's something I must hear. Joined the brotherhood, my books were all to me. I scribe the words of God and much of history. Many years was I witched out upon the sea. The waves would wash my
That was Lorena McKennett, or Lorena McKennett, with Skellig. And I want to come back now to, we were talking before the music about the Victorians and their, the way that medievalisms were sort of kind, or medievalism was coming back into vogue in that period. And you were saying a bit about it being to some extent a sort of response
or engaged in some way with the process of empire building. And I thought it'd be interesting just to perhaps to explore that a little bit more before we go into some of the other manifestations.
I mean, it had a lot to do with how they were trying to build or create a national history and a national identity that then linked to the idea of empire. So part of it meant reaching back to the Anglo-Saxon period, to the pre-Norman conquest, to this idea of their history before the French, and then to build it in a way that created a continuity with their own culture, in a way to justify then the strength of their empire and the colonization of other regions. And they chose Beowulf in particular alongside other figures. I mean, Alex mentioned Arthur at the beginning, and this is another one that pops up. There's a slew of them. Charlemagne, interestingly, who's not actually an English icon, gets pulled into the mix. But King Arthur and Beowulf in particular are seen as figures that can be adopted as national icons. And in a way, the Beowulf story is shed of some of its pagan or non-Christian elements. And he's presented as a very, as the Anglo-Saxon ideal. And there's this idea that the bravery, the courage, the heroism that you see in his figure is appealing to individuals that want to talk about how these are the qualities that we need in our troops, but also in the men that lead our country, in our citizens, and the members of our household. So if you run a tight ship as an empire, then you run a tight ship as a household. And so your household can be this microcosm of it. And so the patriarchal leader might, for instance, read some of the stories of heroism about Arthur and Beowulf as a child, and that they would have didactic elements that would teach them to be loyal and just and brave. It's really, in some ways, a brainwashing technique, right? I mean, it's a didactic message that goes into the children's culture that then becomes part of the mindset of how you run your household and how you live your life. And it links to this national identity as well. And King Alfred, another Anglo-Saxon figure, gets pulled in a lot. So there's a sense that these narratives are often adapted or rewritten. So it's a type of medievalism in their deployment into children's literature. Sometimes they get a little bit sanitized. One of the writers that I've been working on, she takes the story of Beowulf and cuts out the third section of the tale in which Beowulf actually is defeated by the dragon and cuts out the pride speech by Hrothgar. So she sanitizes the tale in a way that means his figure becomes an emblem of perpetual victory rather than demise or pagan culture and demise. So it's this reworking.
So what would have been wrong with the pride speech for anyone who doesn't know the text?
Simply the fact that he was even flawed, and especially because there's a real tension in the narrative between the pagan and Christian elements, and but also a respect for the pagan elements from the Christian side, the author or the scribes. There's a sense that there's a value to them, even if they were not fully correct because they didn't know the right God. We can learn from them. And so we see this in some of the children's texts. We see this in versions of Chaucer as well, where narratives are taken out of context and reworked into a frame that perhaps something like The Wife of Bath's Tale, the prologue will be left off because it has all of this questionable material about female sexuality and female challenges to male authority. So that will be removed, but the story itself that she tells is kept within the framework. And then authors often saw Chaucer as the father of English. So there's this sense that reading Chaucer is a way of accessing your historical roots, your history and your origins as a culture.
And would we recognize their Arthur given the kind of manifestations we're familiar with now? Or is this a very different version of it?
I mean, I think you would agree what we have is very much informed by the Victorian.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's whether the original writers would recognize Arthur that's more of the question.
Yeah. The Victorians, so much of what we have, I mean, T.H. White, for instance, when you get The Sword and the Stone or even The Once and Future King, he's drawing heavily upon Malory, but also upon Victorian interpretations of Arthurian myth and Malory. So he's informed by that context as much as his own. And I mean, he's been referred to as, even though he's writing quite late, and The Sword of the Stone, I think, is 1937, he's been referred to as the last Victorian writer because his material draws so heavily upon those those influences and those texts. So certainly, I think we are greatly shaped by what happened in the past. Well, not the past century anymore, but the 19th century.
We've also got to remember that, you know, that the Victorian era was the era where we were getting 360-degree medievalism. So it wasn't only coming through literature or literary motifs or topoi. It was coming through painting and through opera. And we would get sort of both the visual
architecture,
the visual and the aural kind of medievalism. So that is bequeathed a huge amount to the 20th century and obviously through to the 21st century, that some of the standard figures and the standard ideas, you know, if you look at the sword and the stone motif, right, and we think about the first image that usually comes to mind when you think of the sword and the stone is from the Disney version, which is a sword in an anvil, if you look at the poster. I mean, it defeats the actual text that we know. So this kind of visual motif is often much more powerful than the text itself. Yeah.
So we said that this sort of leads us into some of the more modern manifestations. And obviously the Disney instance just given is one of them. The one that comes straight to my mind that we were talking about a moment ago while the track was playing is sort of Monty Python version of the Holy Grail. And I wonder if we might think a little bit now about some of these other ways that it's, you know, this whole trope of medievalism, if that's the phrase I want, has moved into the moving image at this point.
Well, certainly, and this is where we really are crossing over territory, Renee and I. Certainly, one of the things that you mentioned very early on in this, the extent to which you're saying, are they coming back more frequently, or has it been an ongoing thing? And I very much agree with Renee that it's always been ongoing, but it has certain kind of ebbs and flows to it. However, what we are seeing and what we have to obviously deal with is there is a lot more material remains for us to deal with now. So what we might see as an explosion in the 21st century with where I've been working with social media is only because we can now see what people are saying, whereas, you know, the verba volent of the 20th century is much more difficult to access. So it's incredibly difficult to try and trace backwards and say this definitely came from this specific element. But what we can see is a kind of a background radiation of medievalism. So when we see things like the emergence of comic books and you know, things like Prince Valiant, we start to see there is a definite debt to Pre-Raphaelite painting in Prince Valiant, but you could not really identify or pinpoint which specific one. Similarly, Prince Valiant is made into a film in 1953 by Henry Hathaway, which and then again in the late 1990s, I think 97, made into another live-action film. And you can see the debt both to the comic books but also sideways to other films and so on. So this kind of cross-fertilization of medievalism becomes extraordinarily powerful through the 20th century. And as it proliferates through one medium, it will, of course, overflow into another from something as commercial and crass as tie-ins and movie tie-ins and action figures and so on. I don't remember a Happy Meal that had an Arthur, but there must be one,
yeah,
I'm sure.
I can't remember. I had a Wonder Woman, but that's Amazonian.
That's indirectly medieval at best, yes.
But certainly the commodity culture that goes alongside it, the fact that you can not only visit a theme park, you can buy artifacts that it's not just reenactment in the sense of going to a fair. It's actually a type of cosplay, right, that you can participate in it by buying these things and wearing these costumes, and it kind of has become that as well.
And the more you play with it, the more it opens up into new spheres, the more it can be then opened up into further new spheres. So there's a book by David Marshall, a collection of essays called Mass Market Medieval, which talks precisely about this commercialization, which shows how, you know, something very simple or something very rooted in a specific historical era then gets kind of commercialized, drawn into rock music, then drawn into other spheres, internationalized, and it's absolutely fascinating to watch.
Yeah. I would...
That was Rondellus, the wizard, from the album Sabbatum, I think, if I'm getting it right. Yes. Thank you. So in a moment, we're going to move on to talk about some of the perhaps more negative or problematic appropriations that you've talked about in the book, Andrew. But I wanted, just before we did that, we were talking towards the end of the last segment about the commercialisation of medievalism through this sort of product placement and the film and television industry. What I was also just wondering during that was, is there in any way a similar kind of sort of didactic agenda to these film and TV productions in anything like the same way that Renee was talking about with the children's literature in the Victorian age, or has it all become much more, I don't know, just sort of intended for entertainment?
That's a question.
Ooh, you
that
got
deserves,
the tough one.
Yeah, that deserves a lot more meditation than I can give it right now. Instinctively, I would opt for the entertainment defence, because first and foremost, if they're not entertaining, no one is watching them. Therefore, there's no point to having it. But that's not to say they're all crass commercialism. There are some films, particularly the more art house end of the cinema, which will definitely try and faithfully reproduce is a very, is not only a split infinitive, but a very, very problematic term, but try to kind of re-invoke a certain era. So I'm thinking of things like Eric Rohmer's Percival de Galois, which was a film from 1978, where Rohmer was a high school teacher and then went into making films. He films, it's a version of Chrétien de Troyes' Percival, or Comte de Crâle, and he films it with the book in hand, right? He does this also with The Lady of O.
Another version of the Grail.
Yes.
Story, isn't it?
That's right, yes. From the 12th century, the late 12th century. And he films this in sort of slightly updated, but only slightly updated, medieval French, with a sort of recreation of a medieval manuscript. So, you can see these parts of these films on YouTube. They are absurd and strange and beautiful and weird and all at the same time. And so there was definitely a didactic element to it, but I would say those would be the more of the rarities than the norm. Others actually can teach unwittingly a surprising amount about the Middle Ages. We've mentioned it keeps skirting around Monty Python, but Monty Python and the
fabulous.
Holy Grail is a fabulous introduction to the Grail motifs. They knew what they were talking about.
So I fear we must now, at least for a little bit, leave the happy entertainment world of Monty Python and others behind and move into more political territory of the kind that you explore in the book. Mm-hmm. So perhaps would you like to say a little bit about the kind of areas the book is thinking about, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Well, the book actually started out looking at something it wasn't. It started out looking at something I didn't look at in the end at all, which was things like the JFK appropriation of Camelot. You know, so this is, you know, obviously JFK goes to see, I understand he goes to see Camelot on stage and comes back and says, this is what I want my administration to be, you know. And I thought this was quite an interesting appropriation of the medieval for political ends. The more I started thinking about that, the more and more obscure and dark corners of the internet that I started to uncover, where the Middle Ages were used for incredibly pernicious, incredibly pervasive, and sometimes incredibly damaging ways. So that was where the book shifted to look at. And so I started writing it around about 2011, which was when Anders Behring Breivik launched his attacks in Oslo, city centre, killing, I think it was 90 people in the end. Where he believed he was a Templar knight. And I thought, okay, no one's suggesting that we can explain Breivik's actions. I mean, I'm neither a psychologist, a sociologist, nor an expert in terrorism. But what I was really interested in was what sort of environment would he have been encountering that would let him see the Middle Ages in such a way? And so I started looking at forums for the extreme right, started looking at some of the ways in which the Middle Ages were informing political speeches and political movements. One of the most obvious ones was people like Jean-Marie Le Pen in the 1990s, who used, you know, people like Clovis and Charlemagne, we've talked about, and particularly Jeanne d'Arc or Joan of Arc, as a kind of a point of contact for French national identity, which is a way of sidestepping the fact it was an incredibly racist and xenophobic manifesto which tried to privilege white French nationalism. And the way that that then becomes absorbed, reclaimed, and reused by the French, through, or particularly those of the Front National or the far right, as a point of reference for them, in the same way as René was talking about in, you know, in the kind of the medievalism of the Victorian Empire. So that was where I started moving towards, and ended up looking at social media and the ways that social media and Twitter in particular will reuse and rework the Middle Ages.
Could you say a little bit more about why you think that they are making those appropriations? I mean, is it the same kind of things that we were seeing in the Victorian period, or are there other motives at work?
I think there's both. There is certainly an element of post-empire. There's certainly an element of nationalism and national zeal, which leads you to look backwards to the past. But taking that same question, turning on its head and looking at it the other direction, one of the books that really got me interested in this whole area, well, there were two books in particular. One was Patrick Geary's book, The Myth of Nations, where he argues, you know, that most modern European nations have their roots symbolically, if not historically, in the Middle Ages. And the second one was Benedict Anderson's Imagined Communities. And so combining those two ideas together, what we have is this imagined community which situates itself backwards into the Middle Ages as the kind of the ur-text or the ur-identity of a given society. And that was the thing that really fascinated me, that if this is what the medieval offers to most users of social media or most commentators or political analysts, most often online, they would be the would-be political analysts of the world. But what it does is it offers this enormous repository, which is really a pick and mix. You can take whatever you want. If you want to believe in kind of a very stout English or Anglo-Saxon national identity, you can go back to Beowulf. You can pick whatever you want. You can leave the pride speech. You can pick. You can ignore the fact that he's not English, and you can make him into something that you want him to be. And I think it's that kind of freedom that actually really will appeal to politics.
So does that mean you had... sorry, did you want to...
Well, I was thinking about Jeanne d'Arc, because she's used by the resistance as much as by the fascist groups. I mean, there's a real duality to her figure.
Right, well, she's been used, I mean, from the erection of her statue in around about 1870, which was during the Franco-Prussian War, she's been used by Protestants against Catholics, Catholics against Protestants, by the resistance against the Germans, and by some of the later movements against the English, by the English against the French, by the English against everyone else, and I mean English, not British, and then lately has been used for same-sex marriage, against same-sex marriage, and it's just so flexible that that's what explains, I think, why it's so appealing.
So do we have any idea who the real Joan of Arc was? Or is this... are they building actually on the reality that the record is so limited that... you can, in a sense, impose the vision you want.
I mean, she's more icon than history these days. Yeah. I mean, and the material that we have about her is very limited. Most of the records we have about her are written by the church. Mm. They are the court records from her trials. Right. There's a poem by Christine de Pizan. There's Alain Chatier, Jean Casson. They both write about her in the period. But the bulk of what we know about her is from the perspective of those people trying to persecute her. So... she's a historical person. Mm. She had visions of some sort. She was, very successful at convincing people to do things for her, whether it be military action. So she was crucial in turning the tide of the war. But, in terms of finding an authentic or a real Jeanne d'Arc, it's a very difficult thing to do.
And that's actually a perfect illustration of what we were talking about earlier about the differences between medieval studies and medievalism. Is that the medieval studies people, they can tell you exactly what we know about Joan of Arc or Jeanne d'Arc. The medievalism will tell you that most people's idea of Jeanne d'Arc is going to come from, you know, the Luc Besson film, or from maybe there's a 1943 film called Le Dernier Le Retour, The Eternal Return.
Or the black and white.
Or the black and white,
The Passion of St. Joan.
The Dreyer.
Which is really about World War One. It's she's used as an iconic figure to narrate the experience of World War One.
Right. And so it becomes, or even Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah.
You know? Sorry, I love that you're taking this to be highbrow.
Sorry.
And keep insisting on returning to pop culture. But these pop cultural references are incredibly pervasive because we don't really notice them. And so that's what the medievalism study really is about, is looking at these, this popular culture. No one's suggesting that actually these might be real, or even necessarily that they're academic or didactic, that, but they're powerful nevertheless, or perhaps because they are such.
Sunlight dances through the leaves, soft winds stir the sighing trees, lying in the warm grass. Feel the sun upon your face. Elven songs and endless nights, sweet wine and soft, relaxing lights. Time will never touch you. Here in this enchanted place, traveled now for many miles. It feels so good to see the smiles of friends who never left your mind when you were far away. The golden light of coming dawn till the twilight, when the sun is gone, we treasure every season and every passing day. You feel there's something senses reeling, this is the place to grow old till I reach my final day. Feel there's something calling you, you're wanting to return to where misty mountains rise. Place you can.
That was Rush with Rivendell. I feel that we have spent a lot of time in the music today, as if we were sort of floating on a very slow-moving barge down a very wide river.
Sorry.
With people playing the mandolin and things. But anyway, I was going, first of all, Renee, to invite you to comment on that song. And, of course, that brings us to Tolkien, who we've not yet mentioned, I think, at all.
Well, I suggested the song because I thought it was one of the best examples of medievalism upon medievalism, right? That you have a song written about a fictional world that is actually engaged in medievalism. So and I think it speaks to the point that Andy made about it, medievalism infusing every aspect of our existence.
Right.
But certainly I think for most people in the 20th century, Tolkien is probably the thing that they identify the most with medievalism. And of course, I think in the last part of the 20th century, early 21st century, what you would have is also a divide between those individuals that have read the book, or the, and I say book meaning the 6-volume big book that isn't a trilogy. Mm. And let's not have that argument.
I've only read it once, so I'm not sure I can do the distinctions.
Or at least later.
Or the Peter Jackson adaptations, the films. So there's this sense that, I think film adaptation constantly re-envisions literature that engages in medievalism. So it brings it to a new generation. Mm. And so, you know, growing up, that was one of the things that I read as a very young child and have read it repeatedly. So I was one of those people that had difficulty with the films for various reasons, recognizing that they are an artistic adaptation and an artistic rendering, and they have a certain degree of license. But also, I think I had more of a negative response to the films because of my experience with the books, whereas some of my students had never read the books and the films were sacred to them. Mm-hmm. So I think it also shows that we can attach to the Middle Ages in different ways, or to medievalism in different ways, and have different experiences of it. This is how we perpetuate different versions of it, is through these types of activities.
Right. And it shows that they do different things for different people. I mean, you know, as much as I love the books and like Renee, I used to reread them, you know, regularly throughout my childhood. It was the films that blew my mind. And, you know, I have photos of me at Hobbiton, you know, and the gleeful, like a little child. it has these different appeals, and it's so pervasive that's, I think, what makes it last.
I sometimes think there's quite a fine line between the scholar and the fan in some of these things. But then I'm working on P.G. Woodhouse, so I really can't talk. Now, there was also an anniversary this week of another fantasy series. I think that's a reasonable term for it. The Harry Potter series, which you were explaining to me earlier, has got sort of medievalism connections. And I thought we might talk a little bit about that.
Well, for me, it's medievalism, it's classicism, it's a mashup. I mean,
it's buildings Roman.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much of what she's doing is drawing on traditions from so many places. So I think it's the perfect mashup in many ways. And then if you add in the films, the theme parks, even the way that you have something like the Universal Studios, the park or the experience, didn't even correctly, when they first built, they had parts of Hogsmeade and parts of Diagon Alley smashed together. So even in the recreation of the films and the novels, so making it look like the film sets, but bringing parts of the novels into one space and making this medieval-style village with a medieval castle, and it's just all thrown into the cauldron, and what you get out of it is something different. And the thing that's interesting about that is, and again, I think this links to the points you made earlier, is that the experience of that, people don't care. They go for that experience to be immersed in it. Or some people care. I mean, I remember walking around taking notes and getting yelled at because I was holding up lines, because I was actually writing down things as I was seeing them. Mm. But the sense of it's about that moment, and it's the experience, or the experiential medievalism. So feeling part of it, feeling part of a community. So being able to share that passion and that love through attending the park, or by being in an online community. So again, the experience of Pottermore is bringing all of that, the texts themselves, into and all of the visual experiences into the digital world. And then Rowling has used that as a way to even expand her texts by adding new material. So you get the backstory of Sir Cadogan, the cowardly knight that falls off his horse for, in one of the paintings. And you get the backstory of him, and you get backstories about other characters that have medieval names or connections to medieval characters in other texts, or Victorian characters, I mean, Mrs. Norris. So there's a real sense that the boundary on what is medieval is very blurred in something like that, and yet there are clear elements within it. I think this is also where what people identify as medieval, the iconic thing, so the castle.
Right,
the knights. I mean, when the Goblet of Fire came out, it was the tournament. That in itself was something that became, even though it was not necessarily grounded in historical fact, and it's just something that people knew had a connection to the Middle Ages. So they become these moments or iconic moments,
which can actually become, in some senses, more real than the real medieval, if you want to call it that way. You know, so the more recognizable, certainly. You know, if you look at the popularity of places like the Harry Potter theme park, or the real theme park versions like Carcassonne or Neuschwanstein, that those people will visit those castles and see real medieval castles because it's more closer to what they expect to see. I think I'm right in thinking that Harry Potter was filmed at Durham Castle, the very first two.
There were scenes of it done, especially the scene where they're on the brooms in their first flying lesson, and there's a section where they have the Whomping Willow attacking the Fort East Anglia.
So you've got that. Well, what you've got is, you know, something sort of vaguely medieval with something genuinely medieval with something added on. And I believe they added on an extra tower and some extra CGI. You can see I have an enormous familiarity with these films.
They used Christchurch, they used Oxford, they used a number of medieval villages. So you have all of these. If you go to these places, they now use it.
But you won't see them in these places. You won't see the extra CGI, which will feel less real to you than the non-real version, which I find is a wonderful paradox for which symbolizes.
But it's been a boost for the heritage industry.
Absolutely,
because they now can then say, X was filmed here, come and see where Harry stood and things like that. So in this really bizarre way, it's become part of the tourism culture in the UK.
It becomes banal in some senses.
Yeah.
Was Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song. And we are, I think we could go on talking about medievalisms and many of these films and disagreeing as fans, apart from anything else, about what we like and what we don't like for hours and hours. And mentioning the various people we decided we weren't going to talk about, like Sir Walter Scott, but we are running very short of time. So, as a final question, why do you think that it's still important that we study and think about these various appropriations of the medieval?
I think for the reasons that we've discussed through the last hour, because they're so pervasive, because they're so useful, because they're so used, and because sometimes they really are used in ways that matter, in very mm-hmm. real ways. And so I think it's fascinating, endlessly so, the fact that they simply will not die. Much like a flesh wound of our sorry, that was one of the things we said we weren't going to discuss. Yeah. They are still alive and around us and surround us. If you walk around this city right now, you will walk through medieval remains next to, Tudor, next to Victorian,
Roman.
Next to Roman. We live in a coeval world, so to try and pretend that we don't, or to try and pretend that each period is relegated to the past is disingenuous.
Yeah. I think for me, there's a quote by the Brazilian writer Alberto Mangel, and he says there's no such thing as an original text. And I think that that's true of whether it's a film, a text very broadly here applied, in the sense that we make meaning of the past in everything we do, and we reinvent it, and that is how we identify, that is how we build. So I think his words, I think, are very poignant, the sense that... We are constantly reinventing through redeployment of what we already know.
Thank you. I think that brings us, as ever, rapidly to the end of another edition of Past Prologue. I hope we've given some of you listening out there ideas for future viewing and reading. I'd like to thank Dr. Andrew Elliott from the School, Lincoln School of Film and Media, and Dr. Renee Ward from Lincoln School of English and Journalism. Remind you that you can purchase Andy's new book, Medievalism, Politics and Mass Media, Appropriating the Middle Ages in the 21st Century, from Boyd Ellen Brewer. I don't know how much it is, but I'm sure if you go on their website, you will discover. And I would like, as always, to thank Alex Nefchuk, my producer, and who keeps everything working technically and locates the songs and all that sort of thing. I am Dr. Finn Pollard, and Past Prologue will be back in about a month's time when we'll be talking about holidays.